talk today about entanglement entropy at quantum critical points, or can you hear the shape of Schrödinger's cat? We'll see what I mean afterwards. Much of this is the result of papers that I've been writing in the past few years. Two of them with two people in the audience, Paul Frenzy and Eddie O'Donne. We mentioned the connection with that and the connection with entanglement entropy in a recent paper with Joel Moore, who's not here. So this, in a sense, is also a little bit of a story of having to give up one's most cherished principles. So when I was in kindergarten, I promised myself never to look at wave functions, which are complicated, ugly problems. Then I happened to be landed into the theory of quantum Hall effect, where you have to come to terms with wave functions that have universal properties, and therefore you have to begin to like them. And the other one I promised myself never to look at is the problem of quantum entanglement of these extended systems, since it's a very non-local and complicated story, which is unclear even today to me how will anybody ever go and measure that. I mean, you can do that for the EPR paradox, for two particles, or things like that, but for field theory, that's really hard. So that's another thing I promised myself never to look at, and here I am talking about that. So we'll see in a moment why I had to give up this principle as well. Okay. Well, maybe for the time being. So we'll see what happens in the future. So the first, I'll give you a motivation for why I have to give up my principles. Give you a lightning review of what entanglement entropy is. I imagine by now you all know it. We'll talk about entanglement entropy and quantum criticality in 1+1 dimensions, which is the only situation where this is actually well understood. To the extent that it's understood. And even there, I'm not sure that you could really say it's completely well understood. I will make some statements later on. I'll go and talk about topological phases and the relationship between this quantity and topological phases, topological field theories and quantum phase transitions. And then I will discuss a special class of quantum critical theories in 2+1 dimensions that have the special property that their wave functions, their ground state, the wave functions which define these quantum critical theories, actually the wave functions themselves enjoy a form of conformal symmetry, which is a very unusual property, actually. It's very, you never have that situation in any other case, as far as I know. Finally, we'll talk about we'll do a calculation of the entanglement entropy of such scaling invariant wave functions and talk about how the things are related, and maybe we'll raise a more general issue that one should worry about. So the motivation here is that the entanglement entropy is a clear measurement or measure of quantum mechanical correlations in many body systems and in field theory. It is, however, a very non-local quantity, which is really hard to imagine even how to measure it in a macroscopic quantum system, because you really need to go and talk to an infinite number of degrees of freedom at one point simultaneously, say, and if you imagine doing that in a real experiment, that's clearly impossible. So even though we may like it as a measurement of correlations and information stored in the system from a point of view of quantum information theory, from a practical point of view, I mean, this is the reason why I promised myself in kindergarten never to look at things like this, you always look at correlations of local operators, you are really on infinite systems, but with local probes. That's normally how we do things. And this is a quantity which cannot be accessed directly by local probes. So there's a question, how does it behave? Does it have a, is there a simple theory of that? So there is some interest in understanding that. So the behavior of this quantity near quantum critical point has been a subject of interest recently, and it's actually largely not understood, perhaps in the case of one dimension where the, actually some understanding does exist. And really what motivated me to take a look at this is actually the results, and some of which we will hear in the next talk, on the behavior of this quantity in topological phases. And we saw something about that yesterday in Carolina's talk. I'll keep going back. So what is entanglement entropy? Let me go back again. Imagine you divide your system into two regions or sets of degrees of freedom, call them phi A and phi B. In a pure state, the wave function is an amplitude, it's a complex amplitude dependence on both, and the trivial density matrix for the combined system is simply the product of this function and the complex conjugate with two different sets of entries. And what you want is a reduced density matrix where you trace over some subset of M stable fields in V. Notice since this is a trace, what you have to do is you need to identify phi B and phi B prime in this quantity and then compute, integrate over all their values, and that's what the trace means. So we will come to that in a moment. And the phenomenon entanglement entropy is this quantity minus trace rho log rho, and is symmetric under the exchange of A and B. And it tells you how, what is the degree of quantum mechanical correlation between these two sets of equations. Now, on the other hand, quantum phase transitions are involve a different sort of description typically. What you have is some kind of local order parameter, namely some local field or set of fields whose local expectation values and their variances and so on can be measured directly. And when you go through a transition, a quantum transition as a function of some tuning parameter, you go typically from some phase where this local order parameter doesn't have an expectation value to some order state where it does. In the case of a topological phase, this local order parameter typically does not exist. But if you have, say, an anti-ferromagnet, this would be the nail state, or the nail order parameter, or something like that. So it's something that breaks spontaneously the symmetry of the ground of the Hamiltonian, the Schrödinger system. So this is a paradigm, or the, if you're on the prototype of all quantum phase transitions, involves something like that for the most part. And if the transition is continuous, namely the order parameter or whatever quantity goes continuously to zero at this critical value of the parameter, then you expect to see scaling variance at in the vicinity of that quantum critical point. Okay, so this is, and what we mean by that is that correlation functions of local operators exhibit scaling. Okay, so that's really what one means that is by quantum phase transition in general. Now, at this transition, there's usually a divergent correlation length, or more than one if it is a multicritical point, but let's say there is one, and it diverges with a critical exponent nu. On the other hand, there will be an energy scale, which we call a gap, that will close like some power of the distance, and that power involves some other exponent that is known as the dynamic critical exponent z. Now, if you grew up being a Lorentz invariant person, as I did, you will never have doubted that the only possible value of this z is 1, but in many other cases it turns out that you may want that number to be different from 1. So in fact, much of what we know about quantum critical systems actually is for theories which have z equals 1. And there is, you know, there are some things which are known, and to some extent the theories with z different from 1 tend to be somewhat simpler in some ways. Okay, so let me talk about one dimension. So one dimension quantum criticality, by now we'll know, is actually implies conformal invariance. So these are systems, quantum critical systems with z equals 1. In 1, they are really special. First of all, they exhibit an infinite conformal symmetry, and therefore they are described by an effective conformal field theory at long length scales. The critical exponents are quantum numbers that label the representations of this infinite dimensional group of conformal transformations. And there is my now, I would say, almost complete classification. Normally say complete classification, but I have to be careful because if C is greater than 1, it's not so complete. There's an almost complete classification of quantum phase transitions of unitary relativistic, that is z equals 1, phase transitions in 1 plus 1 dimensions in terms of CFTs. The central charge or conformal anomaly and the coefficients of the operator product expansions of the primary fields define the universal properties of the CFT, in other words, things that don't depend on the microscopic physics. And there are two quantities I actually want to flash here because it's somewhat relevant to what is going to come afterwards, that are commonly calculated. In particular, there are quantities which are in some sense local operators, but they're related to integrals of them. One is the specific heat, which is a thermodynamic property of the system, scales the specific heat per unit length, scales linearly with the temperature. There is a non-universal quantity here, which is a velocity that relates length and time, but apart from that, what matters is this quantity C, the central charge, apart from everyone's love number pi over 6. Okay. Similarly, if you calculate for a finite system, there are the finite size corrections for the ground state energy, and the finite size corrections take this form. There is this term, if you want, called this a Casimir energy. They scale like 1 over the length relative to the energy density here, and they have the same coefficiency, which is known as the central charge. And you will see in the calculation of the entanglement entropy, this coefficient will come up again. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to flash these expressions. All right, so what about entanglement and conformal invariance? This is a relatively new subject. It's mostly, the last speaker said that if you only know what happens in one case, you don't have a theory, you have to do a theory for cases or something to have a theory. Well, this is sort of, it's been a case-by-case scenario where people have built up some understanding of the subject in different models, and then someone noticed that there was some generality to the result. So for instance, there were calculations in a number of spin chains that led to the suggestion that the von Neumann entropy in 1D for quantum critical systems in one dimension has a universal term that scales like the logarithm of the size of the observed region. So the idea here is you take an infinitely long chain and you take a segment of length L, which is much bigger than the lattice spacing but much smaller than the size of the system, and you ask yourself, how does the entanglement entropy of region A respect to B or B respect to A scale as you make that region larger and larger? But you first made your original system infinitely big. That's important. Okay. So there is a, this actually came from a recent result. Actually, it's not so recent. It's a few years ago already by Rico, La Torre, Vidal, and Kitaev. And it was actually generalized afterwards by Calabresi and Cardi, and actually beforehand by a proposal, an old proposal that had been laid in waste, more or less, because people have forgotten about that, by Halsey, Larson, and Wilczek back in 1994. So they used conformal invariance to show that if you do this sort of calculation, the entanglement entropy, in other words, the von Neumann entropy, will have a term which is linear in the size of the system. And in this field, that is in the kind of problem these people were interested in, it's called the area law, because they were interested by, reduction of a complicated problem of trying to understand, using a few theoretic language, the problem of the area law of information in a black hole. So where the information scales not like the volume, but like the surface. In one dimension, this actually, the surface would be 2 points, and what they found much to their surprise is that there wasn't a finite contribution, but a logarithmic contribution instead. And in fact, it was most of the calculations that people did back then involved actually a simple theory C equals 1, and the coefficient was pi over 3, and it was proven in great generality by Calabresi and Cardi some almost 3 years ago, that the coefficient here is actually none other than the central charge. Okay. Now, away from the critical point, Calabresi and Cardi have, yes?
What accounts for the non-universal term?
Why that comes from the short distance behavior, because you're multiplying fields, if you wish, and short distances, that does depend on the regularization that you use, and there are always degrees of freedom that exist there, so there will be something that actually sits.
But aren't you only destroying quantum correlations along near where you make the cut? I mean, you cut out a segment of length L.
I'm sorry. This term is okay. There is no linear term. I'm sorry about this. There is no linear term in one dimension.
Okay.
This actually came from the other case that I will discuss with this person.
Okay.
This is a finite term that is non-linear.
Dangers of cutting and pasting.
This is the danger. Right, this is the problem here. But in a sense, the issue here, so that term, those terms are somewhat similar to these two. So in a sense, they look like sort of like finite size corrections, if you wish, to the ground state energy or to the specific heat, if you wish, or the specific heat itself. And therefore, So in a sense, that's where most of these calculations come from. There are some technical issues involving how you calculate in the vicinity of these points. You need to use a peculiar conical geometry that they had to it's a rather technical calculation that leads to this. The result is actually quite beautiful. Now, a priori, one wouldn't have expected to see a simple answer. This is not a is not a quantity related to local operators. And I want to contrast that precisely with the quantity before. This actually comes from the conformal anomaly. In other words, comes from the behavior of the energy momentum tensor, which is a local operator. And it's usually calculated by looking at OPEs or the energy momentum tensor, whereas this quantity is not. So it's a much more complicated object. And a priori, one wouldn't have expected something like that, I mean, at least not naively, for something like that to take place. And it's actually rather nice that it does happen, that something universal one can say.
So here, this, what's the subleading term in 2+1 dimensions is actually the leading term, right?
Yeah, here this term is, yeah. There's a finite term which is non-universal.
No, but the first term is finite here as well. That's not, right? So this one actually. No.
This is a little. This is the actual. I'm sorry about this. I shouldn't have said. This is cut and paste. Right. I'm sorry about that.
So the universal term is actually the leading term.
It's actually a leading term. So away from criticality, on the other hand, there is a finite length scale. It's a correlation length. And therefore, this actually, this looks like an infrared divergence. Therefore, it's going to be cut off at that length scale. And now you may actually have finite terms. Now, these finite terms here, clearly, if you change your microscopic cutoff, because it enters in the form of one L over A, it's actually going to modify this number. But now, this quantity becomes some physical quantity, which is fixed for you at that some given value of the coupling constant. And therefore, this ratio is no longer something you can change. And so you may expect the finite terms to actually take a more interesting behavior. And actually, so there's a question of what they are. In one dimension, so far as I know, there is no particular theory of this that is known at the moment in that they may play a role. So the only thing we know, in fact, is this nice result, and this also was pointed out by Calabresi and Carli. So it's a finite number, still the coefficient, provided that C is sufficiently long, much larger than lattice spacing, this is still supposed to have the same form. It has been found afterwards, actually also in 2004, as it turns out, but it was subsequent to that result, as far as I know, by Gil Raphael and John Moore. They looked at a very different problem. These are one-dimensional quantum disorder systems with quench disorder, and they look at their behavior at their so-called random fixed points, and there, too, they find some effective logarithmic law with some coefficient. Now, one has to be a bit careful about over-interpreting this result, since those are, by definition, since it's a fixed point, they do obey scale invariance, but it's not obvious that in the disorder system there is some sort of conformal symmetry, at least not as far as I know, or no one has ever been able to prove that. So I'm not entirely sure how to interpret the coefficient in that case. But they have been able to see, for instance, I think some recent work, that if you perturb the system, much as in the case of conformal field theory, this coefficient actually goes down. If you have relevant perturbations.
I thought it was a formal consequence that if you had a scale and rotational invariance in a two-dimensional field theory, you also have conformal invariance.
Right, but the problem is that you have, in a random system, you have quench disorder. So in any given sample, the system is not even translation invariant.
I see.
So it's only an ensemble average that you have that. So whether the things actually survive in the sense of the probability distribution of this quantity to be sharply picked and have, so in other words, we don't really know what the variance of this quantity is in a random system to know whether it's a good mean, if you wish, okay, whether it's actually representative. And so it's believed to be the case, at least in a number of cases that Daniel Fisher has looked at for various other things, they seem to be actually representative, the representative term in the ensemble actually exhibits the correct scaling behavior, but that's not the same as proving conformal symmetry. And so it's a number, and I'm not sure what the theory of that number is. It's right as one, it's only non-numerical.
But it's not one.
Well, for the IC model is 1/2, okay, so it's not one either, but we understand from some other, you know, using conformity variance or using other things, we understand where the number comes from. In this other case, it's more of a... It's
I'm talking about C, I'm talking about Z, the dynamic...
Well, the dynamical explosion. So it's actually quite a complicated theory in that sense. Nevertheless, this quantity appears to be a law of its
own. Universal.
Well, so far as I can tell, but it's not. So it's an interesting question. I'm not entirely sure who understands what that means. So it's an open question.
I was confused by your previous comment that in the case of psi finite, you said the finite terms should be universal.
No, I didn't say they are universal. They could become universal if you go to the limit where the correlation length becomes of the order of the lattice space, as you will see later on. In general, there is no reason for this to be universal.
No, that's what I was going to say.
But in the other case, in the gapless case of criticality, this term is universal and the finite term certainly not. We went to see in the case of a two-dimensional system that, in fact, these terms in some sense become universal in the topological case. So what are some of the issues? So one of the questions that this suggests is to understand the behavior of quantum entanglement near quantum critical points in general, and in fact not only one dimension but also higher dimensions. We need to understand the dependence on the dynamic critical exponent Z, not C, but Z. Okay. Which dependence, in a sense, determines the nature of quantum criticality of local operators. We know that the nature of the quantum critical points do depend strongly on the value of the dynamic exponent. For the case of a massive relativistic free field theory, so Z equals 1, this is all resolved by Shrednicki back in 93, I believe, that they obey this area law, which is actually what started much of this, the old part of this field, which has its Lyman as well scaling. And Calabresi and Carli actually, at the end of their paper, have a number of heuristic arguments in higher dimensions where they sort of favor this to be the generic behavior where the coefficient in front in general becomes some sort of scaling, crossover scaling function, the one of the crossover from criticality to some stable fixed point. But it's actually a heuristic argument, and in fact, even if you take their results literally, they would apply for any value of the dynamical exponent z as well. And I'm going to show you that to some extent there are counterexamples to those claims. So I think there's something that needs to be understood. So I'm going to show you that there are a class of theories in 2 plus 1 dimensions which are critical of reconstruction, actually. They have dynamic exponent 2 and actually do have a sort of a universal logarithmic term. And interestingly enough, these theories are actually proximate to topological phases where recent results, like the ones that Michael Levin will discuss next to me, I imagine, there are universal finite terms in the case. So let me talk about, since we're going to talk about topological phases and so on, we need to talk a little bit about spin liquids. I think many of you know this, so let me go over this rather quickly. So these are liquid phases of electron fluids and spin systems, liquid meaning that they don't break any translational or rotational symmetries, neither do they break any internal symmetries. And this is really very hard to achieve outside the quantum Hall effect. The excitations are vortices of this fluid, we normally call them quasi-particles, but what it means is a vortex in the fluid, and they have typically fractional charge if they're great and reversal, and fractional statistics. Could come both the abelian and non-abelian fractals. There's a hidden topological order and the topological vacuum degeneracy in all these cases. And then there are these things that actually we are all interested in, which is their potential applicability for topological quantum computers. So what are the interactions that are known by now? Well, we certainly have the two-dimensional electron gases, the abelian and non-abelian fractional Hall states. And these are the ones we know best. The situation rapidly rotating both gases, so there's a potential one at nu equals one rotating bosons. As far as I can tell, the current experimental situation is that the experiments have not been done, or actually they have not been able to reach this regime. I'm not sure, maybe Nick knows, you have followed this more closely.
Yeah, I haven't heard of much, well, I haven't heard of any progress really.
They seem to have technical issues that they sort of get a gigantic vortex in the middle that sort of preempts again. So there are issues with how they make their traps. So that's what at least the BEC people I talked to keep telling me about, I'm sure it's true.
If there is a recent news is that Jean Dalibard in Paris is making a new start with trying to work with much fewer particles than before.
I
so you more easily reach this limit of higher rotation.
Right, because usually the problem was the term which is quartic in the confining potential, but that had also the tendency to produce this big hole in the middle. At some point it looked like they were going to do this in short order, but now they seem to have stopped, so it's good that someone's doing it. Now the good news is now we have, I guess by now we all call it a confirmed case of a time reversal breaking superconductor, the strontium ruthenate. There are at least now three experiments that coincide or agree on this situation, and actually before, say, 8 or 9 months ago, this was unclear, it's now confirmed, but it's by different groups and different techniques. There is a P plus IP superconductor. Now, it's not a two-dimensional system, it's a three-dimensional system that is strongly layered, but as the samples get better, this will be a good playground for non-abelian gossip. Although they are much harder to manipulate because they are more
spin.
Hmm?
It has spin.
The spin is polarized. Remember, because it's spin is not, it's P plus IP, it's like a B phase.
It's ferromagnetic.
Hmm?
It's ferromagnetic.
The angular momentum is essentially perpendicular to the layers.
I think what really happened with that, they found an experiment that if you apply enough magnetic field along with E axis, spin up will disappear, spin up, and spin down will disappear, spin down.
That's not quite enough to make it not a big deal.
That's very true. But that's what they have done so far. But we know that this, at least we know this parity is reversal and parity breaking from, say, the Kerr effects experiments, and more recently a more detailed analysis of this junction. So I think this is going to be an interesting area to watch for topological fields. So what are now the challenges? Of course, the challenges is all of the cases that I have discussed. First of all, all of these are, except for the case of the superconductor, that is gapless only in the sense that there is a phase mode. Aside from that, all of the excitations are fully gapped. This is all still a question of whether the gap is truly necessary. Can there be topological liquids with could be truly gapless, this so-called algebraic spin liquids that a number of people have worked on. So far as I know, these are interesting wave functions that are still a very interesting Hamiltonians, but maybe I'm wrong. So this actually is an open problem, and it's partly an issue that people have struggled with for quite a long time. So there has been some progress, actually, at least at the level of models with abelian statistics, and perhaps non-abelian ones. I'll go over that very quickly. So let me go over very quickly the type of wave functions that we're going to be looking at. So these are wave functions that arise in the context of quantum diamond models, but many of these results actually survive past that. So the typical example is the so-called Sarkeesian point of the quantum diamond model, where the wave function is a linear superposition of diamond coverings, where you take the coverings, each covering as a orthonormal set of states. So you have that. Actually, this can be generalized in many ways, and we have been involved in generalizing this. All of these theories, in some sense, are all the same. So you can put some weight here that depends on the number of parallel dimers and various other things. But many of the properties actually don't change as a function of that. Many of the exponents do change, but the topological properties, in particular the central charge, does. Now, for bipartite lattices, these are critical systems, as we have known by now, with a dynamic exponent Z of 2, as it turns out. And for non-bipartite lattices, they become topological Z to reconfined phases. And as a function of various interactions, these states may actually have phase transitions where these guys may go into order states. So they actually are a nice playground to ask many of these questions, at least at the abelian level. So you can do that. And we have by now also an effective field theory for understanding this problem. So let me come to the theory. That theory was developed by Mosner, Songi, and myself, and in more detail with Eddie Ardon and Paul Fendley. So it's essentially a coarse grained version of the height model, which is, so you can take a height model and you can take a continuum limit of this height model upon some rescaling of the variables. There is a compactification radius that comes from the discreteness of the Lyomorphs actually. But aside from that, so in terms of a phase variable, but you can write down a quantum model in the continuum, which has a kinetic energy term, which is rather traditional, pi squared over 2, where pi is the momentum canonically conjugate to phi, in other words, phi dot. But instead of being your old friend, the gradient of phi squared is the Laplacian of phi squared with some coefficient. And this theory has, as you can see by inspection, z equals 2. Turns out, if you do an analytic continuation to imaginary time and look at the action, this sort of model was studied by people in classical statistical mechanics interested in the physics of classical liquid crystals, and in particular in the understanding symmetric layers in three-dimensional classical liquid crystals, where phi is essentially the deviation of a set of nematogens. Here's your nematogen, here you have a bunch of them. They form layers, and these layers oscillate the departure from equilibrium. In that language, is this given phi. And these are the things that make your LCDs and your computers work. Okay, so they are quite important to us, for even for classical computers. Now, this quantum Hamiltonian can be understood in the Schrödinger picture, which is another thing that I promised myself never to do. Okay, so you never touch the Schrödinger picture, which is, of course, the same as never touch a wave function. Okay. So you can do this in canonical quantization. You can define two operators that contain a linear functional derivative in phi and the Laplacian of phi. And so these are like creation and inflation operators, and the quantum Hamiltonian is, as in the case of harmonic oscillators, the anti-commutator of these things after shape. The ground state wave function is annihilated by this guy, Q, and the solution has this particular form, is the exponential, so in other words, looks like a local weight. So it's a local functional of the field that depends only on the field and its derivative squared. Now, if you don't know anything else, you say, well, I've seen this guy before when I was interested in my previous life in classical critical phenomena in two dimensions. This used to be called the C equals one boson. Okay, well, in fact, if you compute the norm of this wave function, which is the norm square of that, it's actually passed into the only difference is a factor of two because you have to square it, and this actually does look precisely like a Gaussian model. So there is some question about compactification, and that actually tells you what are the vertex operators which are exponentials of the field phi which are allowed.
Right. You need the regularization also.
Sure. But we're interested in long distance physics, so most regularizations would work for this. So this is a C equals 1 Euclidean conformal field theory. So notice a special property. This is a wave function which is conformally oriented in the long distance limit. And even if you take a 1 plus 1 dimensional critical system, which is usually studied using conformal field theory, the wave functions are certainly not conformally oriented, they are scaling variables. Actually, they are covariant, but they are certainly not conformally oriented. And this here, the wave functions have this special property. And I don't know of any other example of a system with a ground state wave function which has this behavior. Now, that's the reason why the equal time correlators of this type of systems of local operators actually obey conformal symmetry. And so you can understand the ground state properties of systems of this type using conformal invariance also. So you can borrow many of the things you know from conformal field theory for systems that have wave functions that look like local waves of this type. And we have been indulging in excesses of this approach in the past couple of years, because it's a good way to get results. So for instance,
can I just ask about regularization? Since the conformal group is non-compact,
yes,
it looks like you're going to have a hard time finding anything in L2 that's conformally invariant.
Well, it's again, you have to worry, this is, that is, you're looking at the long distance. It's always, conformally invariant is always broken and short distances, and in fact, the fact that you have a conformal anomaly is a reflection of that fact. Otherwise, you get certainly that's correct. So one of the things we did is we with Eddie and Paul, we looked at this mode. And actually, I want to come back to this partly because of the discussion that arose during post-talk. So where we had a model where we called it is a version of the quantum of the Baxter model. A quantum version of the Baxter model is not the simplest one, but it's the one where the wave function has the property that the local weights look like the weights in the classical Baxter model. So you can apply the same sort of analysis. So now you have a wave function, which is an exact zero energy ground state, but which exhibits all kinds of phase transitions with lines of fixed points and all kinds of things. There is an order, there are two order states depending on the various weights. There is this region here that, again, when I was growing up, I always thought it was the most boring part of the phase diagram. It used to be called the high temperature phase in the classical problem. And it's not an area that you're particularly interested in, but in this language is actually the topological phase, as it happens to be. And why is it the topological phase? It's because if you think of this as some sort of loop mode with charges mode 2, which in a sense are natural if you come from essentially an ideal state, set of states which are here, these loops are very tiny, they are strongly suppressed in this phase, they proliferate when you get to this phase transition, and they keep proliferating, essentially they have already condensed or proliferated throughout this phase. So they can actually access the topological properties of the manifold. In particular, they know they can tend to work on a torus or they don't work on a torus or things like that. So in fact, there is a particular point over here that corresponds to the Kitaev mode. So our mode reduces actually to the Kitaev mode at this point. So in a sense, this one of the reasons, at least in my mind, for studying these peculiar quantum phase transitions is they can be used as a crutch if you want to access to interesting topological phases. In that sense, they are approximate. Now, you may be very far away to the place in the Kitaev mode where the correlation length is actually zero, and all of the universal topological properties are easy to calculate, but those properties at sufficiently long distances should be a property of the entire phase, okay, and not just of that point. So in that sense, it's good to be able to access that phase. Now, you may be able to access that phase from using a Z2 gauge theory as well, and coming through a Z equals 1 quantum phase transition, much like a 2 plus 1 dimensional Ising model, which is the dual of that. But that's going to be very far away, and that's a phase transition that we only understand numerically at this point. Whereas here we have a wave function that allows us to do all kinds of calculations for this. So that's one of the advantages of doing this calculation. Of course, in doing that, you buy a lot of baggage which is non-universal, that is actually built in the Baxter model, and it may not be particularly interesting, but it does contain a lot of different properties which are of interest. So that's what I think is one of the reasons why one may be interested in this type of quantum critical points, and this also includes the non-abelian relatives, where this is much harder to do, and that's actually something that we have attempted to do with Paul. We looked at essentially the Fibonacci theory in terms of a chromatic polynomial loop gas wave function that we constructed explicitly, which has many of these properties. And now this is a problem which is much less understood. The analog of the Baxter model, if you wish, which would be squaring this, which more or less we sort of guessed what the answer had to be for things to work if things were right, and you have fortunately proved that's correct. But this is still, as a loop gas model, is much less understood than the corresponding case of the Baxter model. So there are many things which we don't certainly understand here. So in particular, it's not entirely clear to me whether one is actually in the topological phase or at quantum criticality. The loops certainly seem to show critical behavior. That's because they have proliferated, but the sort of quote microscopic degrees of freedom associated with local operators, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is something that at least I am confused about. Maybe Paul has a different understanding, but it's something that I think needs to be sorted out. In addition, something that we never figured out is to have a nice representation of the Hamiltonian for this. We had a Hamiltonian which was local for my standards. In other words, it didn't extend all the way to the Andromeda Nebula. It only involved a finite number of hexagons, actually 3 or 4, But that's too much for anything that is realizable in a simple way in laboratory, and we're still searching for a better representation of this.
But even that Hamiltonian, you wouldn't know if it was gapped or not, correct?
Well, the only thing we know for the moment is the ground state wave function. And
yeah.
One could do conceivably, even without complicated Hamiltonian, a single mode approximation calculation for the for some collective modes and try to see whether they are gapped or not. And we have that. The Hamiltonian is sufficiently complicated that I haven't tried.
See, I would quit physics before.
So, I mean, that's, you know, that's the last resort that we would have. So I'd rather have a simpler
but that would only be an approach to try to find the gapless mode. I mean, it wouldn't tell you that.
Well, the other way to do it is to actually show that equal time correlators of interesting local operators, see, for instance, with broken, you know, with not loops but curves, whether those things scale. If those actually have a power of behavior, then I think it's an indication that it's actually a critical phase. On the other hand, given that it's just a wave function, either we have to be that or something with a fairly short correlation. We don't know that yet. So that's what I mean by saying that this loop gas is not something we understand. So this is something that needs to be done, and the back to some of these issues that I haven't answered. I got sidetracked with this other problem of calculating the topological entanglement entropy at quantum criticality. Tell me, how much time do I have?
I don't know, we started at maybe 1:45 or 10:45.
Okay, so one of the reasons for looking at this, and this actually what I'm interested in doing, is there's this interesting recent result by Gitaev and Preskill and Levin and Wen, that in addition to the expected linear term in two dimensions, and this is a term which is non-universal, essentially of entanglement entropy, is the existence of this finite universal term in the topological phase. Now, I think we need to understand a little bit when this is correct, when this holds. In principle, this holds deep inside the topological phase, in the regime where the correlation length is essentially the lattice spacing. Away from that, there will be presumed a rather rapid scaling. The correlation length will scale rapidly to zero as you coarse grain your system, and presumably the approach to this result should be rather rapid. And with D being this universal constant that we saw several times today. Now, people have attempted to calculate this explicitly for the one simple example that we have, in addition to the one we had yesterday, which is the diagonal model in triangular lattice, where the wave function is known, it's this RK wave function. And this is some recent numerical work that was posted a few months, a couple of months ago, I think, by Miskic and his collaborators. And they tried to do this calculation numerically, and even though they say the answer is consistent with log 2 here, it's consistent with many other things. And the error bars are huge. It's also consistent with zero. If you look at it with the eyes of a loving mother, you will say it is log 2, but I could have said zero too. And in fact, we have been doing calculations using a different algorithm for that, and it's actually not, it's surprisingly difficult given that I thought that this should be an easy finite size correlation calculation. It's less easy than I anticipated. Maybe our numerics is not as smart as it should be. I'm not, of course, a numerical person, as you know, but other people are. So this is an interesting question. On the other hand, there are also interest in this result also showed up from work that we heard earlier on this week at single point contacts in non-abelian quantum Hall states, and which have suggested a new meaning for the boundary entropy, which had been known from quantum problems and one-dimensional boundary conformal field theories by Affleck and Ludwig, which were never quite clear how to interpret them correctly. They were called the boundary entropy, was clearly not residing at the boundary. So even the physical interpretation of those quantities were problematic, and I think one of the things that is beautiful what Paul and Matthew Fisher and Chaitan have done is actually to give a new interpretation in terms of the higher dimensional theory, the topological field theory associated with this. So there is a question then, how does one understand all of these things as part of a single body of theoretical, of some sort of theory of quantum physicality distribution? So this is one problem. And the other is approximate the fact that in the case of these two-dimensional conformal quantum critical points are actually right next to topological phases, suggests that this one actually can use that as a way to understand some of these issues. So the question is what, and there's a more, it's a bigger issue which I will not address here, is what is the universal signature of the entropy in general quantum critical systems in all dimensions? And I think this is an open question. Whether or not there is a universal piece to that in general remains to be seen. So let me address the case of the understanding. So let me come back to this question. You will see in a moment why I call this, can you hear the shape of Schrödinger's cat? So we're going to represent the wave function of these quantum critical points as a linear superposition of states, so it's a path integral over the essentially configuration space of a set of weights, which are going to be my wave functions in the field representation, if you wish. And the point that all this, the issue that all of these theories satisfy is that this quantity I'm calling S by an excess of terminology of S over 2 is local in the field. It's going to be gradients and gradients of the field square and things like that. And the entanglement entropy is going to be calculated by taking the trace of rho log rho, or you do this, some people call it, I think, with an abuse of terminology, the replica trick. So you take a rho to the n, and then you take the limit of n goes to 1 after you compute the derivative relative to n. So it's a, yes, it is actually a definition of a logarithm as well, not just the replica trick. The use of the term replica trick evokes the a different replica trick that is used in spin classes, which has a lot of other problems, and in particular the analytic continuation, which is to n equals 0 there, is actually rather problematic, and it's never been entirely clear whether one knew how to control that, whereas here there shouldn't be any difficulty in continuing down to n equals 1. So in this particular case, what you do is you sandwich rho A between two configurations in A, so phi 1A and phi 2A, and so you want to compute a quantity like this and trace over B, so you identify the configurations in B and leave the configurations in A arbitrary, so you have this more complicated beast. Okay? Now, the in the trace of rho A is actually, rho is normalized to unity, the trace is 1, but the trace of rho to the n is not normalized to unity, and that's what one is computing here. And notice what's going to happen here. Inside one region B, these two copies of B have been identified with each other because I need to compute a trace. But when I compute the nth power of this matrix, I have to multiply, I have to identify essentially the in and out of the brass and the kets in the A region with each other in the nth power. So I have essentially a scheme like this. In the region called B, I need to identify the fields. In the region A, I need to identify the fields of one matrix with the next one. So in a sense, what one has, that is a case of rho squared. So this is region A and this is region B. So what I have is two sets of fields in A and in B, which are forced to agree at the boundary. And then you're supposed to compute these traces. And the computation of the traces consists of this identification, and then I need to compute this path integral. So in a sense, this is a problem that one should be able to understand how it works. And you go through the analysis, what this means is you have n configurations that agree on the boundary divided by n independent configurations. And you compute the ratio of these two partition factors. So that's what trace of rho to A to the n is, and also it's also trace from B to the n. Now, I'm going to show you a simple calculation for the case of a free field, which is in the case of the wave function we discussed before, but this actually is more general. It applies essentially to any wave function of this type, and many of the things that I'm going to say that involve the following field theories apply, provided the boundary conditions that I'm going to apply here can be generalized in this case. So for the case of the free field, it's very simple to see that if you have n configurations that agree at the boundary, you can always take one configuration which is like the center of mass and a bunch of relative configurations like that. The condition that they agree on the boundary means that these configurations, these relative configurations, have to vanish there. In other words, have to be obey Dirichlet boundary conditions on the common boundary. So apart from the center of mass, which is this one, which sort of decouples from the rest in this case. So in the other cases of more complicated theories, there is always a possible definition of a Dirichlet boundary condition, or in other words, a conformal invariant boundary condition that can be defined. So in that sense, this calculation applies to the other cases as well. So, so I'm going to write, yes?
Question here. Do we need to integrate over the boundary values in the Dirichlet boundary condition?
Yeah, so they are not fixed there. They are arbitrary. In fact,
yeah,
the sum over the arbitrary values and the sum over the center of mass is perception. So in that case, essentially what this does is essentially computation of a partition function over some region, which is region A, raised to the n minus first power times a free part divided by n copies of the free part. And so if you calculate that, the trace of rho a to the n, then it's this ratio raised to the n minus first power, and of course, the actual entanglement entropy, which is the derivative of this as n goes to n, you take the derivative and then take n goes to 1, then reduces to this ratio here. And if you put what this quantity is together with that, you get z8 and zb over z3. And so what is interesting is these are is a product of two sets of partition functions over A and B obeying separately Dirichlet boundary conditions divided by the free, the overall partition function, which is essentially the norm of the wave function that we were discussing. So remember that the partition functions here are nothing but the norm square of the wave function. So there is this interesting formula that looks like the mutual entropy in that sense, that says that in this language, the entanglement entropy is the free energy defined to be the log of ZA for FA, the log for B, and then minus the log for the N. And so that's what you get here. Is it, is what is in, okay, in that sense, that's the answer. Okay, so then the problem reduces of understanding how to calculate these quantities. And we, there are a lot of things which are known about these partition functions from conformal field theory. Since now these are partition functions of a two-dimensional conformal field theory, I can go back to what is known about these partition functions and read off the answer. So there is in particular a nice paper by John Cardy and Ingo Peschel back when this is in the late 80s, which generalized a calculation, actually an argument by Mark Katz, called the Marcotte's law, can you hear the shape of a drum? Marcotte sort of conjectured and gave a number of arguments for the free energy of, for the essentially the random thermal fluctuations of a two-dimensional surface, if you want the drum head. So it would have an area term, and this in there is an extensive term, there would be a perimeter term, and then he showed that in general there was some logarithmic term with some coefficient. The case that Katz studied at C equals 1, and then he studied the case where the boundary was sort of a set of polygons with various angles and so on. I'm going to comment on that in a moment. And also had some conjectures about the dependence on the topology of the manifold. And Cardy and Peschel sort of used conformal field theory to generalize this and show that this actually works for any CFT with a Dirichlet boundary condition. So the quantity, so for a, essentially for a closed region with some boundary, the quantity chi here is just the only characteristic of the region of manifold, which as you know is 2 minus twice the number of candidates minus the number of boundaries. And this is true for a smooth boundary. For the boundary has singular points, I'm going to comment on that since it's of some importance. And so this actually gives a logarithmic term for this quantity. Now, if you calculate what this actually implies for the entropy change in particular, what you need to calculate is this quantity, which is a change in the Euler characteristic. And the point of that is that in general, if you compute for two regions with smooth boundaries, with one is wholly enclosed in the other, you find precisely that these things cannot possibly change the Euler characteristic, and therefore chi of the union is the sum of the chi's, and therefore you get zero. So that being said, it is true that there is no logarithmic term. In that sense, this is consistent with the argument by Calabresi and Cardiff. There is, however, a finite term that depends on the logarithm of the aspect ratio of the regions. So there is there are finite terms like that that survive. But more interestingly, if you perform essentially a surgery of your region, in other words, if you imagine that by physical means you actually take your region, which is A union B, and you physically split that in two, which is much like the point contact argument that Paul and his collaborators were doing, here this actually will lead to a change in the Euler characteristic and therefore to a change in the entropy. So in other words, now the fact that you went from a single system to two systems will actually give you a change which is proportional to the log of the size of, say, the system that they have in this country. So in this case, too, you expect a logarithmic term, but it's present only if you change the topology of the system. Otherwise, it's not. There is another case where it happens. So imagine that region A actually ends at the boundary of their common boundary, which is over here. There will be some angles. Or if region A happens to have singular points, in other words, there will be some angles or cuts. In other words, it's not smooth everywhere. Then there is a generalization of this formula. There's an extra term that depends on the angles as well. And these terms will appear. And this is important, I think, in actually many of the calculations, because the calculations usually run on lattices. And so you always get, you know, sharp angles, whether they are hexagons or things of that sort. You have to be careful when you do that. There will always be contributions coming. Even if you take a system which is in the topological phase where this will be some finite number, which will be the law of the correlation, then you will still have a dependence on the shape of the region. And this actually may be slow, and I don't know how that scales as I move into the critical, from the critical regime deep into the topological phase. So that's something that needs to be understood to figure out what these calculations that people are doing actually mean. So this actually brings me to what happens in the topological phase. And the topological phase, which is proximate to that, you'll expect, again, this is not there, you'll expect to have this term where this is now finite, which will be cut off at the correlation length. But the question is that maybe there will be an actual truly finite term where this is equal to the correlation length, which is this topological piece that is a part of what is interested in extracting. And I think there is some theoretical work that needs to be done in understanding how one takes this. So the conclusions are that, so we examine the behavior of this entanglement entropy in a number of 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum critical points that have conformal invariant wave functions, and which are proximate to topological phases, and they have, so there is this interesting logarithmic term that appears here and has a dependence on something that looks very much like the, it's essentially the central charge of the theory associated with the wave function itself, since the full theory doesn't have really the conformal anomaly, it's only the wave function has that. But it's only seen in processes in which you take the topology of the manifold, it's only there where you can see that. Okay, otherwise, it's not present. Now, there is a general interest, which I think is an open question, of understanding these sort of behaviors for other types of quantum phase transitions. So imagine that you wanted to access the topological phase from, say, the more general Z2 gauge theory, which has a confinement-deconfinement phase transition. I don't really know what the behavior is of this quantum, that transition, and I don't think it's understood. So let me stop here.